coming up on the 17th. If you haven't been baptized, you need to be. Come, just let me know. We make it easy on you. A towel, a change of clothes is all you need. Invite all your pagan friends so they know they can quit inviting you down to the Hyperion Grill and all those other places that you practice paganism together. All right. Hey, I want to begin this morning to preach a series. I want to introduce it this morning, but then I'll preach it on Sunday nights. And I want to talk to you from the book of Esther. You ask the question, why would you want to talk from the book of Esther, written 2,500 years ago? And I think that the reason books like Esther are so important, and I include Esther and Daniel together in my thinking, is that the culture in which they're written and the challenges in which the people face seem to be so similar to our own. But when you think of Daniel being written in the middle of the Babylonian Empire's heyday, and then Esther there in the middle of the Persian Empire's heyday, those were cultures where those who acknowledged God and were trying to live righteous lives were in the minority, and they faced great pressure from the larger culture to cave. Those were cultures that were built on power and prestige. They were built on idolatry and sexuality, and they were cultures that put pressure again on the believers in Yahweh in a way that the culture of today, I think, begins to put pressure on you and I. And so I think they have something to say to people living in America in the 21st century. Now, the book of Esther is a book that is famous because God is never mentioned in the book. And yet it is the plan, it is the process in which God saved the Jewish people from annihilation, from extermination. And so it's a book in where God is everywhere, but he's never mentioned. He is in the shadows, so to speak, hence the title. Now, we're not going to get there this morning. We'll get there this evening. But the overarching theme is that there's a man named Haman who is the prime minister. He works for the king. He has the plan of extermination, but God eventually raises up a young woman named Esther who becomes queen, and using her, the plan is thwarted and the people are saved. So having that in your mind, let me look at chapter 1 with you. Verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia, "in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all of his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the province being before him. And when he had showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days." Then I'm going to skip down to verse 10. So he's showing them all that he has. And did you catch that? It's a 6-month party. And in verse 10, this is what we read. "On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded me, human, guess, and a lot of other guys to go get Queen Vashti." Verse 11. "And to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and to the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. And then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, Those closest to him being a bunch of other guys, he tells them, he asks them, what should we do? And they say, you gotta send Vashti into retirement. I won't read in verse 2 there. He said, you gotta read chapter 2. You gotta send Vashti to retirement, because if word gets out that your wife said no to you, we will never be able to get our wives under control. And so they have this beauty contest and enters in chapter 2, Esther. But I just want to focus on chapter 1 this morning, because again, here's the king, and this is a fabulous passage. A lot of flavor here. He's having this party, and if you looked at the verses in between the ones that he read, the people at the party say, hey, your wife's famous for her beauty. Why don't you go get her and bring her here so we can see her? And again, we read, the servants are sent to Vashti, and this is great. They show up, and I mean, you know, this could cost her life. And they say, the king wants you to come and show your beauty to him and his friends. And she, one of the most courageous things you ever have in the Bible, she says, well, you tell King McNasty and his nasty friends that the queen shan't be walking the catwalk tonight or any day whether to, forever and ever, amen, peace out. And so then they got to find a new queen. Now, let me just focus on this passage this morning. Point one, don't be the king. Don't be like Ahasuerus. Don't be a McNasty. Stand firm, because, again, you know, I don't want to throw this guy under the bus, because he's a man and I'm a man. And you know, the whole book of Esther is really slanted against men, because every man except Mordecai is stupid as rocks, and every woman's like 10 times as smart as the men. And so you want to try to even it up a little bit here. But this guy is very much a man of his times, and he's very appearance driven. And so here he is, he's the king, and he wants to show all the guys how much money he's got. And then they say, let's see the queen. And he says, all right, I'm the king, but I'll cave to you guys. And so he's married to this beautiful woman, and then when she says no, he puts her away, and he ends up having a beauty contest and says, let's see if we can find somebody better looking than her. I'll marry her. He's very much man of his times. And in our culture today, again, the similarity is there. Naomi Wolf wrote a book 30 years ago, and it was called The Beauty Myth. And according to her, and you always, I think, have to be careful when people say this is the worst it's ever been. I mean, that's a big statement. We got thousands of years of history. But she said there has never been a culture that valued beauty more than our culture, physical beauty. She said there's never been a culture that attached its self-worth to either our own physical beauty or having beauty as arm candy. That we place this great emphasis on the appearance of things. And you think about that, even in terms of ourselves. You look at our culture, and 92% of people living in America think they're overweight. Part of that is because the average model, if you see somebody in a magazine, the average model weighs 25% less than the average person, and on top of that, she's been photoshopped, or he's been photoshopped. You have these images before you. Cosmetic surgery is a multi-billion-dollar industry in America. And one out of every five searches on Google is for pornography. And pornography is a complicated thing, but at least part of that is also this infatuation with beauty. Because I don't think people who are looking for pornography are looking for some body types. I think they're looking for other body types. And even when you turn on the news, apparently you can't read the news unless you're handsome or you look like a supermodel. We live in this culture that is driven by the appearance of things, by beauty, just like the Persian culture was. I think Naomi Wolf is right. And the question is why? And then that's a complicated answer, and I'm not sure I know why. Some say that it's just the way we are, and maybe that's true because our flesh is a warped situation to deal with. And maybe there's just something innate about us that's drawn to stare at certain images and make judgments. I remember Jack Nicholson was interviewed many years ago, and they said, why do you always get rid of your girlfriends and find younger ones? And he said, it's biology, man. Men are always drawn to women who are able to reproduce. That's what it is. It's biology. It's like, that's a crock, isn't it? And maybe biology has something to do with it. I think we're getting closer when we say that it's human nature, and maybe more so human nature for you and I, to judge things on the appearance because we believe that what we see reflects what we do not see. And there's some perhaps truth to that. I mean, if you're interviewing a person and they come in and they're wearing a t-shirt with holes in it and they spilled coffee on themselves and they're wearing sweatpants and they haven't combed their hair, you just sort of assume he's not going to do a good job for you. You sort of assume that what you see reflects who he is. He's a careless person. So there is a sense in that, that may be true. But again, you and I live in a culture where you have fairy tales and Shrek aside, not thinking about Shrek, in all the fairy tales, the good people are pretty and the mean people have warts on the end of their nose. And that gets ingrained in our culture, in our minds. Livy is our second oldest, and many years ago we took her trick-or-treating. And she was dressed up. It's probably some Frozen character. And all the other kids got a bag full of candy but her, because I think she was afraid of strangers and she wouldn't go to ugly houses. She only said she was going to the pretty houses, so she only got a handful of candy. And in her mind, I guess she thought good people lived in pretty houses and not so good people lived in ugly houses. Which, that's sort of what you see in the movie, right? The ghost, the witch, and the werewolf is always in the old haunted house that hasn't had a paint job in a while. That there's a way in which we do think that what we see somehow tells us or gives us clues about what we don't see. Some psychiatrists say it's even about our fear of death. If I can look young, that means death is a long way off. If I look in the mirror and I look younger, then maybe I'm 80, but the Botox keeps me from thinking about that. I don't know. I do know that there is this fatuation with what we see. And the problem is, first of all, that it makes us miserable people. I don't think it's any harder to age in any culture than ours. I mean, aging is tough many ways. And what you have, again, I think there are a lot of particularly women who are living somewhat miserable lives because they're married to men who are obsessed with beauty, and unfortunately, she can't look like 20 the rest of her life. Of course, it never dawns on him. He looks old enough to be her father, but is making us miserable? Remember Genesis chapter 29, Jacob is in awe of Rachel's beauty, but Laban, the father, says, if you marry Rachel, you got to take Leah with you. And in Genesis 29:17, all it says of Leah is that she has weak eyes. And the translation, some say bad eyes. One translation says she had eyes that do not sparkle. It's not that she had bad vision, it's that there is something wrong with her eyes. And because there's just something wrong with her eyes, her husband doesn't love her, although he keeps getting her pregnant, but he doesn't love her. And when you read about her life, it's just a miserable life because her husband, Jacob, can't see past the physical. Makes us miserable people. Not only does it make us miserable, it makes us stupid. Because somehow what we see, even though we know it's true, we're still judging on the appearance of things, and there ought to be something inside of us that knows the appearance of things isn't reality. Again, we live in a Photoshopped world. I've told you this. I was going through Facebook a while back, and I saw this person, and I said, "What's wrong with her house?" Because the door frame was turned in. And it's like, oh, she photoshopped herself with one of those hourglass photoshops. You really ought to do that in front of a blank wall, not in front of a doorway. But it's a Photoshop world in which we live in. And you know, guys can look at girls. Listen, those may not be her eyelashes. That's probably not the color of her hair. I mean, you might be a teenager, but one thing you need to know, you need to start Googling. Maybe you don't need to Google this, but you need to be aware. Go ask your mother about shape-shifting undergarments. Because that may not even be her shape. And you look at a guy, that might not be his hair. That might be his mama's car. You don't know what the reality is. And in fact, you know, I was thinking the other day about the changes. I've been pastoring now for about 20 years. And when I started out, I was thinking about marriage counseling, the questions you would ask. You know, there's a question you ask now that you didn't ask 20 years ago. Were you born biological male? Were you born biological female? I mean, you don't know what you're looking at. If you're going to get married today, particularly if they're from California. Yeah, I said it. You better get that elementary school yearbook and see what they look like when they are 8. I mean, we look at the appearance of things, and yet the Bible says God does not look at the appearance of things. He does not look at the outer appearance. 1 Samuel 16:7 says that God does not look at the outer appearance. God looks at the heart. People like you and I ought to be looking at the heart of the matter, even though the culture says it's all about what you pose as. It's what you can put on Facebook. It's how you can Photoshop the situation. We live in an appearance culture, and we ought not buy into that cultural aspect. Now, it's interesting when God says to Samuel, listen, you look at the outside, I look at the heart. That's when he's going to anoint King David. David, I think, had 6-7 brothers, and all of them looked better than David. And in fact, the text says, don't look out at the outer appearance or the height. Because I guess David was shorter than his brothers. And if you think about it, it made sense to look at the height, because in that day, the king led the army in the battle, and you wanted somebody who looked like a Greek god at the front of that battle. In fact, I read somewhere that William Wallace, Braveheart, his sword, they don't know how tall William Wallace was, but his sword, which is in a museum somewhere, is 5'6" long. I mean, he was just a massive guy who could lead armies. That's what they wanted. Samuel probably wasn't looking at the height. as much as the size of the sword they were carrying. But again, if you know how to use a slingshot, you don't need a sword. It's not going to come to that. He's looking at the sword. And because Samuel, even the prophet, could not get beyond looking at the outward, he almost missed out on King David. Who have you missed out on because you can't look past it? There are people in churches everywhere saying there aren't any good men, there aren't any good women to marry. No, there aren't any people that you find sexually attractive. Quit looking at that. Look at the heart. There's good men and women to marry. And you're missing your David because you can't look past the past or past the appearance of things. Look past that. Listen, money, prestige, looks, all those things fade. They do. And half of it is put on anyway. Even Esther chapter 2 verse 12 says that when she wins the beauty contest, she went into a year of beauty treatments. Even Esther had a year of beauty treatments. I wonder what she looked like the next morning. It was funny with guys. When I was younger, I used to laugh at the guys who always, you know, hiked their pants up real high, you know. I found out why, though. Because if you get your pants up high enough, you can tighten the belt and mash your stomach in. That's what they're doing. Of course, you get them up too high, and then the belly's down there, you look like Humpty Dumpty. So you got to hit the middle. It's a facade. God looks at the heart of things. Don't be like Ahasuerus, but do be like Vashti. Do be like Vashti. Again, this is amazing because here the king sends his eunuchs to her. And she has the wherewithal to say, no. 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 I'm not going. And it could have cost her her life, I suppose. But she says no. And I don't know where she got the no from, because she wasn't a believer. She wasn't a Jew. She wasn't part of the covenant people of God at that time. But she has the wherewithal, and maybe that came from her sense of self-respect. Maybe she just said, listen, I'm not arm candy. I'm not a body. I'm not just something to look at. I'm more than that. I'm a person. I'm created in the image of somebody bigger than myself. And I am more than that. And I'm not going to reduce myself to walking your catwalk. Or she could have said, and maybe this informed her, she could have discerned the character of the people who were asking. So maybe it was about her own self-worth. Maybe it was that she looked at it and said, listen, you guys are a bunch of knuckleheads. I'm not doing anything for you guys. You guys can pressure me all you want, but you guys are worthless in my eyes. You guys don't have the clout to pressure me. And you and I ought to do that, by the way. You and I ought to have a sense of self-worth that we're created in the image of God, and that ought to matter to a great degree. And then when pressure comes on us, we ought to be able to look at the source of the pressure and say, no, not for you guys, not today. I mean, when people pressure you to use drugs, guess what? They're called drug dealers. You shouldn't care what a drug dealer thinks. When people pressure you to drink, guess what they're called? They're called a person who probably can't handle their own drink. They might be an alcoholic. They probably a drunk. I'm not going to allow a drunk to pressure me. When you're dating a guy and all he wants to do is to hook up with you physically, guess what? Well, they got lots of names for him. I'm not going to say him in church. But I wouldn't let mess with him. That guy's an idiot. McNasty is what he is. I wouldn't mess with him. Why would you let him pressure you? What would that say about you? I mean, some of you, and I know it's harder when you're in a marriage, and you ought to love your husband. You made a commitment to him. But if he's getting between you and serving the Lord, at some point you're going to have to say, honey, I love you and I'm committed to you, but you're not Jesus. And my commitment is to Jesus above you. If you got friends who keep pressuring you to not be the man or husband you ought to be, they're always calling you, and you know you need to be with your family, but there's always fishing, there's a game, there's always something going on. You look at those people and say, listen, you guys are a bunch of lousy fathers and husbands. I'm not going to allow a bunch of lousy fathers and husbands to turn me into a lousy father and husband. No, I'm not going to do that. All temptation comes from the devil, really. You're going to allow the devil? Is the devil worthy of influencing you? You've got to have a no and stick it. So don't be like the other guy, but be like Vashti. And then third, understand how God is working in your life. You're not going to be able to see, but understand it. Here in this culture, a culture of Ahasuerus, you have to be able to see that even though God is in the shadows, God is working. Because, again, the whole book is about how God saves his people and blesses them. So from the very beginning, it's about the revelation of how God saves his people and blesses them. And so how does the salvation of God work? I mean, you read the book, and are there plagues? Are there prophets? Are the waters parted? Is there a pillar of sky? Or a pillar of fire in the sky? Is there a miraculous thing that happens? No. The king gets drunk. That's how the salvation begins. The king gets gassed. And then he sends his guys to get the queen, and act two of God's salvation plan. She says no. Now, I guarantee you, nobody would have been sitting in the palace of the king as he's getting gassed and acting the fool, saying, boy, it's great to see a plan of God coming together, isn't it? I mean, if you've been outside of the door when Vashti said, over my dead body, peace out, you wouldn't say, wow, step two of God's great plan to save his people. Isn't this great? I can see it so clearly. The response of the king, the anger, and then the beauty contest. See, I grew up conservative, so if I'd have been there if Esther had asked me, should I be in the beauty contest so I can maybe be the 400th wife of a pagan, I'd have said, no, come here, I'm going to cast that demon out of you. Are you crazy? Don't do that. You shouldn't be parading yourself in that manner. And why would you want to be married to a man like that? I'd have tried to talk her out of it. But here's the plan. Esther gets put in the place of Vashti. And then when the plot hatches, Esther is there to whisper in the king's ear and to save her people. I mean, think about how God worked that out. Again, not plagues, not miraculous events. See, here's the point I'm trying to get. Oftentimes, we're praying for the miraculous. We get down and we say, Lord, give us a miracle. We need a miracle. Maybe there's already a plan in place that's coming to fruition through ordinary occurrences in our life that God is working our salvation on. You have to be open to that if you're a Christian. I mean, you stick with the women in the Bible. Think about Ruth. Everybody talks about how great the romance was between Ruth and Boaz and how much they blessed each other. And I mean, that's one of the top five marriages in the Bible. How did Ruth and Boaz come together? Well, there was a famine in Moab. First step, it took a famine, and the famine killed her father-in-law, brother-in-law, and her husband. And it brought them back to Bethlehem, where she had to go to work. She had to go to work in a field where there were guys that maybe weren't so nice, because Boaz had to tell all the men, if you lay a hand on her, you're going to be in deep trouble with me. So the famine, her husband dies, she has to come back and work in the fields as a laborer. But Boaz was in the field. See, some of you ladies are looking for Boaz. Get a job. Might be there. Might be where you find your Boaz, right there. But you think about that. The plan was way back here. And then you think about, Ruth's mother-in-law, which was Rahab. Rahab is practicing the oldest profession in the world in Jericho. And she helps out spies who come in from Jerusalem. The walls get surrounded. And Rahab was the most blessed woman of her day. Let me say that as a precursor. Because she is the great-great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus, but she's also in the lineage of King David. And Boaz was rich, which means her husband was probably rich. So in the second half of Rahab's life, she was probably standing on the porch of a big old house. They owned all the property she could see, and she was able to watch her husband and son work in the field together. Think about how blessed that was. But that only happened because Rahab's in the city, and the city that she grew up in got destroyed. Everything she owned, she lost when the walls came tumbling down. She ended up getting hooked up with the Jews and made the journey, and there were battles yet to come because that was one of the first battles. So she basically lived through the war of the conquest, but it only would have happened if she... It would never have happened if she hadn't lost every single thing she had in Jericho and had to go with them. Do you have faith to believe that God is at work when you can't see it? Because we're back to the first point. Do you go by what you see, or do you walk in faith? Are you so visual that if I don't see the miracle, if I don't see the pillar of fire in the sky, if I don't see the waters part, if I don't hear the word of the prophet, if there's not a voice from heaven, God must not hear me. No, there could very well be a plan, but the famine is part of the plan. The drunk king is part of the plan. The walls falling down in your life, that's all part of the plan to get you to where you need to be. If you could see that, you could live with a lot of hope. Because you don't know what God's up to. I don't know what God's up to. As long as I'm obedient, I assume there's a plan. I got to walk in the plan, but if I'm following Him, there has got to be a plan. And not only would it infill us with hope, but I think it would infill us with a great degree of peace of mind. Because it's not on me. God's at work. God's at work. I'm praying for my children. God's at work. It's not entirely on me to convert them and corner them. God's at work. I'm looking for opportunities, but God's at work. It's not entirely up to me to have a life that is reasonably happy. That may not be happening now. If I get there, it's because God will be working. Amen. Takes the pressure off, doesn't it? I mean, by the time you get to Esther, It's like, Esther, just go talk to your husband. I've done the rest. Just go talk to him. Yeah, all these people will be saved if you'll just go talk to him. I've already done the rest. I've set up the point. I've got you teed up, Esther. And that's the way God works. Can you believe that? Can you trust that? You're going to have trouble trusting that if you go primarily on what you see. But if you walk by faith, you can walk in hope and peace. Amen. Stand with me.